I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, specialist in hospice and palliative care, and this is Dying to Talk, a new KALW series dedicated to transforming the taboo around death. What do Halloween and El Día de los Muertos have in common? They each transform the taboo around talking about death. In honor of these upcoming rituals, KALW's Dying to Talk and Reimagine End of Life Week have come to the heart of our community with an audience-attended panel discussion with Rene Yanez, curator of San Francisco's Dios de los Muertos, and Ned Buskirk, creator of You're Going to Die, joining me here at the Here Collective in San Francisco. Join us and our conversation after this news.
This is the BBC News. Hello, I'm Nick Kelly. Ancient towns and villages in central Italy have been rocked by another strong earthquake, close to the region where nearly 300 people were killed in August. Around 20 people were injured in today's tremor. An evacuation last week following strong aftershocks may have saved lives. The quake destroyed the medieval Basilica of St. Benedict in his birthplace, Norcia, the town closest to the epicentre, as well as historic buildings in Amatrice, which bore the brunt of the August quake. James Reynolds is in Norcia.
There has been significant damage to this town of Norcia. I'm standing outside one of the main ancient gateways to the town, protected by an old wall. And masonry has come down to the left. There are firefighters in front of me who've sealed off one of the entranceways towards the piazza, the main square, where the church has come down. I can also see dozens and dozens of residents sitting calmly in one of the town's parks here. They believe that that's the safest place for them at the moment. We've all felt two aftershocks, which sent masonry falling down from one of the entranceways. A lot of people here are traumatized by the fact that this is now the fourth major earthquake they've had to suffer in the last 2 months.
The European Union and Canada have signed a landmark free trade agreement that took 7 years to negotiate after the objections of the Belgian region of Wallonia were finally overcome. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, attended a belated signing ceremony in Brussels with three EU leaders, including the Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, who said the deal set an international standard that would have to be followed by others. The CETA deal removes almost all tariffs, and officials hope it will generate an extra $12 billion a year. Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate Mike Pence says the FBI's investigation into newly discovered emails, said to be linked to Hillary Clinton, shows that she's a risky choice for president. Mr. Pence commended the FBI for investigating the emails and informing Congress about the move. On Saturday, Democratic Party senators asked the FBI and the U.S. Justice Department to give more details by Monday about the Bureau's probe. The senators argue that the decision to reveal the existence of the emails less than 2 weeks before the presidential election is being used for political purposes. Iceland's Conservative Independence Party has emerged as the biggest party after Saturday's parliamentary elections, but will need to assemble a coalition in order to govern. The party, which won a third of the seats, will need the support of at least two other parties to form a majority. Its former ally in the governing coalition, the Progressive Party, lost support. Its leader, Sigurdur Ingi Johansson, has said he'll resign the post of Prime Minister. The anti-establishment Pirate Party came in third place. World news from the BBC. A series of bombings has hit the Iraqi capital Baghdad as the government offensive to drive the Islamic State group out of Mosul continues. A car bomb killed at least 10 people at a fruit and vegetable market in the Huria district, and there have been several other attacks in other mainly Shia areas of the Iraqi capital. Rebel fighters in the Syrian city of Aleppo have continued to fire rockets and artillery shells at government-held districts as part of a new offensive launched on Friday. Activists say the rebel bombardment has killed at least 38 civilians. Sebastian Usher reports.
This is the second time in the past 2 months that rebel groups in Aleppo have tried to break the siege on the areas they still hold in the east of the city. It comes amid a series of broken ceasefires and abortive efforts to get aid convoys into the rebel districts. The rebels, spearheaded by Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists, have used car bombs and improvised artillery known as hell cannons. They're attacking on as broad a front as possible, trying to draw pro-government forces into street battles. Civilian casualties have been high. Both Both sides are now accusing each other of using poison gas, while Syrian and Russian warplanes mount a counter-offensive.
Saudi Arabia says it has thwarted a plan to bomb an international football match in Jeddah. The Saudi Interior Ministry said the plot involved a car bomb being planted at a match between the national team and the United Arab Emirates. The ministry said it had also foiled a second plot to kill police officers. And there's jubilation in Bangladesh as the national cricket team have beaten England by 108 runs in Dhaka, their first victory over a full-strength side from a major nation. All 10 England wickets in the second innings fell in a single session after tea. The result means the two-test tour has ended in a draw. The tour had been put into doubt by militant violence in Bangladesh. BBC News.
Welcome. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, and this is Dying to Talk, a special series on KALW tackling taboos around death and dying. Today's program is a little different for two reasons. First, this broadcast is part of an inaugural Bay Area Reimagine End of Life Week, which includes more than 35 events happening throughout San Francisco's Bay Area and even the world. And all of these events are intended to inspire conversation and imagination, transforming a taboo subject of death into the universal human experience we all share. Details of all of these events can be found at letsreimagine.org. Second, this broadcast of Dying to Talk is being taped with a live audience. Let's hear it, audience. Woo! This courageous audience has gathered together in the Here Collective, which quite literally beats with images of human hearts on the wall in the heart of San Francisco's Mission District. One of the amazing things about this particular time of year is how unconsciously we seem to move as a community toward recognizing and honoring death as part of life. During today's program, with the help of our panel of guests, as well as the Here Collective audience, we aim to discover and even experience the power of rituals and art, both ancient and new. Joining me on stage are two gentlemen pioneers bringing rituals of death and grief to life. René Yanez is the co-curator of Soma Arts Cultural Center's annual Dia de los Muertos exhibition, and really, the person credited with bringing the tradition of El Día de los Muertos to San Francisco nearly 50 years ago. René, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
And Ned Buskirk is the creator of the monthly live performance in San Francisco called YG2D. You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes. Ned, welcome to Dying to Talk.
Thank you. Very honored to be here.
So, you're both really at the epicenter of a movement. And I'd like for you to begin with your own origin stories. How did you come to this conversation and then begin your version of it in the community? Perhaps, Ned, we can start with you.
Sure. It's an old story. I feel like it's easy just to go to my mother's death in 2003, and that loss, kind of the propulsion of that into the mortality conversation and the eventuality that we all are going to die. But I feel like at a pretty young age, I was fixated to some extent on death, but didn't have a place to talk about it. We'd watch shows like Ripley's Believe It or Not, and there's just a lot of dead things in that show. And I don't even know why I was allowed to watch it, but I would just go to bed just imagining like sarcophagi, and I think that's the plural of sarcophagus. And Jack Palance's voice alone is just dripping with death as far as I was concerned. And so I would be laying in bed at night and just feel that indefinable overwhelming truth, you know, this the feeling of your mortality, you know, this unknowingness, the thing that you can't wrap your mind and your words around. And I remember coming down to my mom and crying and also having her meet me there but never really talking about it. And when she got sick when I was 13 and fought breast cancer for 13 years after that, we never really talked about what that was, what that cancer was, what her potential inevitable death was. It just wasn't an offering in our home. And I don't fault her for that. I understand that that's how we work as a culture sometimes, that like to get through life, we often need to not be in that truth. Jump to all these years later, and I just simply start an open mic in the city doing my master's program at San Francisco State. And it started just as a space for people to be themselves and share themselves vulnerably and share their creativity. And after doing that for a couple years and having it, feeling the need for it to continue and feeling the momentum, a lot of things aligned. I found the space Viracocha, which is this beautiful basement venue in San Francisco's Mission District. I'd been a part of a fundraiser where I figured out that the event as an open mic is completely essential, but it also needed to be curated to allow artists to be able to come in that are really good at what they do to share in this conversation. And I was talking with a buddy of mine. It hadn't been named You're Going to Die yet, but I was sitting in this North Beach alleyway on the steps, and my buddy's trying to help me figure out what to call it. And he asked me, well, why do you do it? And I remember sort of eating my deli sandwich on those steps and looking out at the horizon and turning back to him and saying, well, you're gonna die. And it just stuck. And then when my mother-in-law passed away about 4 years ago, the next show that I had, up until that point, it was like, you're gonna die, get it out, be creative, what do you got to lose? Just get up there, be courageous. When my mother-in-law died, in that very first show after she died, there's a moment I had in the show where I talk about what the event is for and my knowing, you know, deep inside, intuitively, without having like the answers around what it means to do it this way and do it in this conversation, just knowing that that needed to occur is what happened there. And it's been that ever since. And I understand the success of it has to do with organizing it and who I can be in the event as an MC. But really the success is from meeting a need that I have, which is to be able to talk about my mom, is to be able to talk about my mother-in-law. And the success then too is because other people have that need and we don't have places to do it often. And so that's kind of the story that leads me to here.
Thank you, Ned. I think that's actually a perfect opening then for you, Renee, because what you curate, what you've brought to San Francisco comes from the same place.
Well, it came from Galleria La Raza. Ralph Maradiaga and I were co-directors, and we were planning exhibits for Galleria, and we came across the idea of Day of the Dead. It was part of our heritage, and we had done some research.
Can you just for a moment describe it for our listeners and our audience who may not actually be familiar with what the tradition of Day of the Dead is?
Well, Day of the Dead is that you invite the dead to come and visit November 2nd, November 1st. You make offerings. You put flowers that they like. You put the liquor that you're honoring the person liked. You put candles so they can find a way. You make the altar beautiful or relevant to that particular person. And we started with very humble beginnings. It was a table, glass of water, a picture, candles, and people really liked the concept. when we first did it, then it got more sophisticated as the years went by. We had Oaxacan traditional altars with paper cuts, very beautiful. But then we started doing installations about politics. Part of the Day of the Dead, the tradition is that it is political. It is, you make fun of politicians. And so that we incorporated that aspect into the exhibitions. And schools started to come. And the students started to build altars in their schools and their homes. And it spread, which, you know, we spoke to the kids about death and how it is to celebrate death, not to be afraid. It wasn't Halloween where it's spooky, but it was more to open up to people from different backgrounds. If they wanted to honor somebody, they could place a picture and invite them to come and visit. So from there, it has grown. I did it at Galleria La Raza. I was there 17 years. Went to the Mexican Museum, and then I went to SOMARTS. And I like SOMARTS. It's big. It has a theatrical lighting grid. It has technicians. I work with an architect. This year we have 80 artists, which actually we cut down from last year, 120. And we try to appeal to students as well as the general public. The theme this year is dedicated to Cynthia Wallace. She was my wife that passed away May 7th. Marta Rodriguez, a mission artist that participated with Day of the Dead. Sylvia Parra, who was Mama Coalt, a singer, a healer, an advocate for women's rights. And the people that were lost in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. So that helps shape the exhibit. And also personal, people wanting to honor people in a personal way. Carla Caletti, her mother died. Also, Black Lives Matter, Brown Lives Matter. El Sapo, who was killed here in the Mission District by the police. He was unarmed. There's a video where the family put together the exhibit. Alicia Cruz Hunt, who's a teacher, has a display about school shootings. And she writes in the blackboard, we have to find a better way. So every station is a story. You know, we have the McConnells, a couple university teachers. They do satire on Trump. They're pointing to the graveyard skeleton saying, you have nothing to lose. So it's it balanced out, but we also have a classroom for students. Daily we have students that come. We have a classroom with black light that participate. So it's intricate, but it has a long history. I done it at Yerba Buena Center for the Arts. I started the processions. Then it just sort of got bored with that. It really changed from the beginning. It turned out to be another thing, which is, it's okay, but it's evolving every year.
What I'm hearing you say, though, is, you know, it starts with the intimate individual story. It's lives. And actually, if you look around this room, if you're here in this room with me, and if you're listening, I'll try and do my best baseball play-by-play so you can appreciate. But there are essentially these very modest ofrendas, these displays, these altars to our ancestors, to people who have died that we love, as a way of giving us permission, as you said, Ned, to speak their name, to bring them into our lives. Because, as Jack Lemmon quoted, you know, death is the end of a life, not a relationship. And I think, Ned, what you bring in gathering people together to share stories, to share music, and what you have brought to San Francisco and invite our community into, Renee, in creating these physical installations, these ofrendas that are either individual or communal experience, right, is inviting us into this conversation and inviting these stories to continue to live with all of us.
I think there is a particularly powerful It's a particularly powerful act to experience people speaking names, people taking action in and out of the lives of those they've lost, because I think generally if that's not happening, really on a there's a level of our experience of that that we personally relate to. So if I'm not talking about my mom out loud, or I'm not hearing you talk about the people you've lost, what's going to happen when I die? Really, like, the relationship between bringing someone into life that has died is reminding yourself or almost creating a portal to a time when you may not be here and someone will say your name, even if it is just a little moment like we had the other night at my show and that we got to do today here before the recording here, of being able just to say names of people. And you can feel it. You can feel it when you say those names. You can feel the energy shift. And even if it's just a base level, all of our energy is shifting because we're getting to do it. We get to say that name that we don't get to say as much as we maybe want.
Actually, it reminds me, Ned, when you say that, that there was a beautiful interview with Lucy Kalanithi, the wife of Paul Kalanithi, who wrote a book called When Breath Becomes Air. And she was interviewed by Charlie Rose. And one of the things she commented on was how happy she was to get to be saying Paul's name again and again and again as she's been on book tour on his behalf since he's died. And that she feels so fortunate because so many people don't get to do that. And that instead our reflex as a community is to go silent, to not say their name for fear of upsetting people, when in fact that's all people actually want to do. And it feels like Day of the Dead, where we say, no, bring them out into the open. Let's look at their pictures. Let's talk about what they love to eat and drink. Let's tell the stories, Ned, at your gatherings, that this is permission to share these lives that are still very much living within all of us.
Well, so, yeah.
No. Go, please. No,
I was just going to say that we invite people to come to the exhibit. The exhibit is free. Schools come, and we're open Tuesday through Sunday. Well, it ends November 5th, so.
So but, get out there.
And actually, for the closing, we have performance artist Guillermo Gomez Peña. He's going to perform a ritual and read. We have Dr. Locos Rocking Jalapeno Band, and to celebrate the dead, and we have Maya Chinchilla. So it's November 5th. We start at 6:30, so please, everybody's invited. And we charge for that, but we have a mercado, and we have food for sale. And we invite as many people, because these are wonderful displays, and part of the thing is that we want to share what these artists are thinking, and they put a lot of effort into this. Some of the artists would come after work from 4 o'clock in the afternoon until 5 in the morning working on these displays, and they put their heart and soul into it, and it does reflect. Please come.
Thank you for sharing that, and we'll have that information on our website, which is kalw.org. You're listening to 91.7 FM KALW. This is Dying to Talk, and I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, here with my guest, Ned Buskirk of You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes, and René Yanez, co-curator of the Soma Arts, Dia de los Muertos. And one of the things you were just alluding to, René, in inviting community to come, it seems like both your events, Ned and René, really demand an experience of community, that to have it in isolation, you could tell yourself your own poem, Ned, and you could, you know, create your own altar for your own home, which you do throughout the year, but there's something that shifts in the presence of community, and I wonder if you could comment on that and the need, perhaps, for that experience.
If you want to go first, go for it.
Yeah, the earliest version of You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes, I really wanted to encourage people just to be creative. And so I would have these conversations with people, and they'd say, well, I play the guitar and I have some songs, but I just don't really know about getting up there to share it. And I would talk just about what you described, this, the act of sitting alone in your room. I mean, that's wonderful. I mean, I love imagining people sitting alone in their rooms reading their poetry out loud to themselves. That's probably uncommon. Maybe like playing a guitar by yourself. But the just like the act, the creative expression of sharing yourself with people, how that act is a transformation for everybody that gets to be a part of it. And in the same way, and add the layer of doing something creative and expressing yourself in the name of someone that you've lost or, you know, that's died, that too is a transformation available to anyone who gets to experience that. Otherwise, it's stuck in us. And I know that personal space. There are layers of the loss of my mom that will just be here, you know, in me. And they are mine, and no one will know those. But there's ways that I can learn who my mom is by getting her out of me in the name of having lost her, if that makes sense. Like, it seems to me, like you described Lucy's talking about her husband, like saying her husband's name again and again, it's kind of a way of learning how to have him in her life now after she's lost him. And we don't get to do that. It's hard to make that space in that time. And I think what my event offers is a place for people to get it out. And it's startling to me how many people come and get up and say, I've never done this before. And what's powerful is not them getting up and maybe singing a song, probably not tremendously well. It's wonderful to watch them do it because they're vulnerably offering this thing, and they're doing it for themselves and for someone they've lost. There's, I mean, it can blow your mind. In fact, in relation and comparison to someone who gets up and says, hey, I've been playing the guitar for 30 years, and here's one of the many songs I play tremendously well. If they don't do it in the vulnerable way that you do need to do it, to give it in the name of someone you've lost, it doesn't have the same power. It can be clean and good, but it's different when you're doing it for that, from that heart center, from that loss.
One of the things that's striking for me, you know, in having attended your event, Ned, but also listening to you, Renee, is age. And what's impressive is, you know, You're Going to Die has a very young audience in general, but spans the age spectrum. And Renee, you mentioned that Dia de los Muertos, you're bringing school-age children. And I know my own children in school have created ofrendas. And this opportunity to talk about death in the context of our ancestors and who we are and where we come from, it doesn't strike them as scary. And maybe do you see how that is able to last culturally, generationally, that how we talk about death as a family and as a community becomes more accessible? Do you see that?
Well, let me explain the process that I have developed during the years of curating that, and my son coming and helping, both Rio and I working together. But it's throughout the years is bringing people together from different backgrounds and creating community, people working next to each other, helping each other, people working after work or taking a day off, but they work 12, 14 hours a day sometimes. And we have technicians that do lighting, carpenters that help build the altars, people helping paint. So it's creating community. And I try to pick people from also different backgrounds, Asian, Black, white, and Latinos, to come and work together. So when the audience, the school children come, they can identify with different factors and encompass how Asian people celebrate their dead, and other people, Native American, we have the bone pickers, how they Native Americans celebrate. So I'm very conscious of that, and people can identify with different cultures and try to balance out that different backgrounds, different issues, political, personal, spiritual, rituals. Everybody brings something to the table, and it's a wonderful time when it's 3 o'clock in the morning and people are working together the day before the opening. So you got to be finished, and everybody's doing details. And if you come and see this exhibit, you'll see that it does take time, and it's people spending 4 or 5 days on one display, and people work in teams. Sometimes there's 12 people working on one installation.
Really a labor of love.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I think, you know, that's what's so remarkable when we come together to talk about death, is the intensity and the intimacy that instantly becomes accessible. You know, one of the things that allowed for this week of reimagining end of life to canvas the Bay Area was this original project earlier this spring, inspired by the Open IDEO Challenge to reimagine end of life. And numerous projects and ideas were generated out of stories from people around the globe sharing their experiences with end of life. And I know there are some people here in our audience that have contributed some of these projects specifically around taking rituals and traditions and cultural approaches as a community to the experience of end of life, and then bringing it forward into our experience today, and how to quite literally reimagine while honoring what's so, reimagining it in a new form. And so I want to highlight one in particular that's in this room for our live audience, and I'll try and describe it. It's something called Memento Mori, and I'm going to take a moment and walk over to one of the creators to share, because I think it really combines what both you and Ned and Renee are talking about. So this is Nick. Nick, thank you for coming to Die and to Talk.
Thank you very much for doing this and having us all here.
My pleasure. So if you could perhaps just tell us the origin story of Memento Mori and how this contributes the way that the Day of the Dead and You're Going to Die converge for us moving forward.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we created this out of the Open IDEO Challenge, and in responding to the challenge, which was how can we reimagine the end of life and bring in kind of artistic elements to it, we discovered sort of the tradition of Memento Mori, which is a Latin phrase, means remember your mortality. And throughout the years, that's sort of taken place in the art world, but a lot of it, a lot of the art that we found was a little bit on the kind of archaic and almost morbid side. So we really wanted to modernize it. And, you know, I'll just say that there's kind of two components to what we came up with. You know, there's a physical part, which is a bracelet, which is in the tradition of Memento Mori jewelry. But then there's also a connected app in which we really want to build the community around it, allow people to share stories about the ones that they have loved and lost, but also the people who they're close to now. Because I think one of the things that we really believe in is, as you mentioned earlier, the relationship doesn't die necessarily when you lose someone. And then reflecting on that, the people that you have in your life now, you don't have to wait to really fully appreciate them and have that impact your life.
That is really the key to everything we're talking about today and throughout the series of Dying to Talk. Thank you for sharing that, Nick. You know, I, for one, love jewelry, and I also love stories. So to combine the two quite literally is absolutely exquisite, and I'm very grateful. You know, there are other experiences I've had throughout the week that are looking at art and design and ritual and bringing this forward to our community as a whole. And I'm wondering, you know, I've been surprised by every single experience I've attended, my eyes have been opened, and I live in this conversation as a hospice and palliative care physician. And yet, each experience is in the eyes of the beholder, and when we can open it up to somebody else, something pretty magical happens. So I'm wondering if both Renee and Ned, you could think about and share with us, and I'll invite our audience to reflect and share as well. What have you been surprised by as you engage in a conversation that you're both intimately familiar, perhaps comfortable, we'll say, yet you're still, I suspect, constantly surprised with what people bring? Can you share something?
Well, this year was very personal to me. My wife passed away. And I asked friends to help me do offerings. My son and other people came and put together this wonderful installation. We have Daniel Galvez. He's a muralist. He's doing on-site painting. He's painting in the installation cubicle. He goes every other day and paints as a tribute. There's a picture of Robin Williams that Cynthia took in 1976. She produced and directed Robin Williams in The Lover, and it's the legacy to her involvement in the theater. People from Texas and an offering, a box offering her. So those things surprise me when it becomes so personal. Another artist developed a coloring page with her face, and I'm just surprised at the tribute and how much people really loved her and liked her, and it becomes personal. This is the first time that really, the first time when my mom passed away many years ago, but this time around it became personal and became part of how I felt and the support that my friends gave me in making these offerings.
I mean, I just have to say how stunning it is. You say it so simply and even plainly. I invited friends to come create this offering for my wife who died this year. You know, I am often approached by people who are struggling with how to support their family or their friends who are dying, and then often feel a burden to do it alone, to create a memorial after someone's died, to create a funeral. And I'm so grateful for many of you in the room who help facilitate that as a community. There's a website called Seven Ponds that really helps people think through these things in a much broader way. But to literally actively invite community into something so intimate and personal so you don't do it alone, and then to be surprised by what shows up and how people hold her and remember her. Such a gift. It is such a gift, Renee. And so, Ned, you create a similar opportunity for people.
Yeah. This was the biggest show that I've ever done this week, last Thursday. And while I can speak about it as if I have an understanding of the value of the shows that I do, to show up at a venue bigger than any space I've ever done the show in and have it filled with 250, 300 people, totally sold out, it's baffling to me at the same time as I completely understand it. I mean, I sat up on that stage completely moved because of how much I care about this movement and feeling all that support from my community and a ton of people that I don't know. And that would be the accent of surprise. When someone comes up to me at the end of a show and didn't know what they got themselves into that night, that's probably my favorite thing. When someone shows up who's lost, maybe a girl came up and she told me that she'd lost her brother and she came to help sing with a band that night. And I had an exchange with her at the beginning of the night where we just were doing organizational things around the performance, And I could sense that we'd never met, and that I literally think I could sense that she didn't know what was about to happen. And then at the end of the show, she came up and she was like grabbing me and shaking me, you know, overcome with emotion and so expressive about this loss of her brother. And as many times that's happened, every time it happens, it just completely takes me off guard. It's as surprising to me as it is surprising to them that they came to this show that's supposed to be sort of a variety show of death and dying, and that they didn't know they were going to be weeping and laughing all the way through the thing. It blows my mind. And I think what's surprising is like the significance, the power of our emotion, and that we need to express these things in the way that we are animals, like, or it's stuck energy, it's stuck parts of our history and our soul. To get it out is to do what all animals do very naturally. You know, when dogs are angry, they just shake or they bite you or they kick their foot or whatever. You know, like, animals do that. We humans, something happens to us and we just sort of sit paralyzed and we kind of want to go home and lay in bed and not talk to anybody at all, and please don't bring it up, you know, even though you really are screaming to talk about it, you know. That's powerful. The creative expression, the outlet, is our version of it. As humans, as heady as we are, as heartfelt as we are, that's our version of dog biting. does that work? You get it?
Passion.
Passion, yeah.
One of the events that I attended was at the California College of the Arts, the CCA, where there are a couple of teachers who actually lead courses specifically exploring death and dying. And to have these young students, undergraduate, graduate art and design students, approach this conversation for themselves and for the community, for the world, is breathtaking. And one of the students offered something I think really insightful. It, again, just blew my mind. Which is, she said, if you first asked me to lead a design project or an art project on death, I would just walk the other way. There's no way. Like, I have no relation to this. This scares me. I want nothing to do with it. But when you put it in the context of design and art, which is a language I am intimately familiar with, I can then have that conversation through that language. And I think ritual and art allow us, a familiarity with culture allows us to engage in subjects that are otherwise too unfamiliar, too uncomfortable, too taboo. But once we have our own familiarity, we can enter. I know I've talked with some of you in the audience about my own personal background as being raised Jewish and a tradition of holding Shiva, that there is a structure to what happens, what you do as a community when someone dies. And having that prescribed then gives there's a freedom to then just show up and then allow what happens to happen. And so really what you both curate in your own distinct ways opens this door of just show up. It will be okay. We got you. And so I'm inspired by looking around this room here in this audience, and I know people who listen at home, you know, you show up. You're engaging in this conversation in your own way, in your own language, in your own approach. And there's someone here today who shared a comment with me, which I'd love your thoughts on, which is when they've engaged with other people in this dialogue, they said, you know what, people aren't afraid of being dead. They're afraid of dying. And I thought that was such an insightful distinction. And how is it that our traditions and our culture and our art can help that gap, that experience, so that we can remain fully alive until we're not?
Well, I think people are afraid of dying with pain. That's why, with both personally and other people, done with pain and how they deal with it and how they go out in public. I want to point out that on November 2nd, Garfield Park, They have altars and thousands of people go by. It's chaotic, but it's people dealing in our way, and around the corner in the sidewalk, people put up candles, and it's become a hybrid thing. It's being criticized a lot because people come from all over the suburbs. Some people are white and some people are not, and it's changed, but it's all hybrid, and it's all an evolution, and where it's going from when we first started in 72 to where it's now after so many years. When I started, I was in my 20s, and I had all this aspiration as to where it was going to go. But it came to the point where I had a choice to make it very commercial and make money from it, but then you lose street credit. You can't get artists to do things because they're saying, oh, you're making money. So it's all these things come into being about death and ritual and ceremony and how people celebrate it in San Francisco, but it's also in Sacramento. They do it in the cemetery. Walnut Creek is different. In Marin, San Rafael, I've been there. I've been to Los Angeles. They do it at the Hollywood Cemetery over there. So it's a constant thing, and it's spreading how they do it in Oakland. It's different in San Francisco. So I encourage people to go out and deal with it sincerely, and if you do it commercially, do it with taste and heart. And if you do it just to honor somebody and invite the spirit to come and visit, you know, do it with passion and heart too.
I have to interject something though, because you started your comment with what you think concerns people around the experience of dying and pain being one of them. And right before this broadcast, we played a game with many of the people here in the audience called Go Wish. And so some of our listeners may be familiar with a prior broadcast of Dying to Talk, when I played the game Go Wish with my family called What Do You Wish? And what we discover is that while there are some people who are afraid of pain, are concerned, and they really want to make sure they're pain-free, we learn that what is pain to one person may not be the same to another. And for some people, actually, pain isn't what they're worried about. It could be something entirely different. And so I think the opportunity to come close and explore, you know, what your community brought, for example, to the ofrenda for your wife, what they saw for her in their life, what was important for them, is not necessarily so for you, because you're a different person, you had a different relationship. And I think that's true as we each think about approaching our own death. And with that, I asked Ned if he would do something with me. So I hope you, live here in the audience, you're stuck. You'll join in. So it's something extraordinary. If you haven't attended a YG2D event, and I encourage all of you to, it's something Ned does as a ritual before each performance. And it's simple and life-altering. So Ned, could you bring us to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's really quite basic. There's not a lot of rules or things that I ask of an audience when they come. But I guess part of it came from me feeling like I spend the whole month in between shows reminding people online, on Twitter, on Facebook, talking to them about how they're going to die over and over. You know, it just kind of gets, it stresses me out a little bit. You know, it's a little confrontational. I mean, who names an event you're going to die? That's crazy. And when I first named it that, it was really hard to talk about it. So, you know, there's something about needing to kind of get other people to take that responsibility off my shoulders. And so simply I would start the show and say, okay, before we get into this, if everybody on the count of three will just say together, I'm going to die. And then we can move on. So do you guys want to do it real quick with me right now? Okay, ready?
But be clear, oh, it's not the quote.
Yes,
right?
Yes. Just to be clear, don't say, Ned, you're going to die. Okay, it is a quote. I have to specify that because I feel like people want to tell me. I'm very clear. I'm very clear that I'm going to die, maybe too clear. All right, so here we go. One, two, three.
I am going to die.
And I mean, I don't know what it's like for the audience. I don't know what it's like for you, but every time I feel quite a bit lighter. It's almost like we've made an agreement for an evening, or we just made an agreement now to sort of be that together, you know?
Renee, we have a question here from someone in our audience asking if there's something about your own mortality and legacy that you've experienced in terms of working with your son all these years on this project.
I think we've been working now for about 11 years. And, you know, I know I'm not going to last a whole much longer. I've been diagnosed with cancer. But I'm glad that he knows the process, knows how we work together. We solicit proposals. We go through them. We work with the architect and technicians for lighting, electricity, sound. So I'm glad that he's sincerely into it. And we don't make a lot of money doing this, but he does it with me, and I'm very lucky to be working with my son. And I really appreciate him. And he's younger. He brings a fresh look. He brings younger artists. And we continue. We try to make the exhibit different every year. We really think about this because we don't want to repeat ourselves. And so we do take some measures. And we do have discussions. And we do have discussions on what our role is in society and how we're shaping as we go along. And I'm hoping that he, if I pass away, he takes over and keeps on shaping the concept of how people, artists, community, children, students relate to death, and not in a morbid way, but in a celebratory way, and bring political issues to light, because it's very important. Black Lives Matter and how those people express themselves, it's very important in educating people. How people feel about Trump is very good for people to question what's happening to our society. Why are we so divided? Why are so many bigots? And why so much attitude that's coming towards immigrant people and people of color? So all these issues are important. So I'm very happy that he's helping me out, and I know he's going to carry on.
I just want to clarify, because Ned just walked us through this. It's not if you die. It's it's when.
It's when. Okay, I got it in the calendar.
It's all of us. I mean, I'm not pointing to you, but we just said that. So to be truthful to that, I'm wondering, though, given that you create these ofrendas, given that you've just done this for your wife with community, do you think about your own? And is that something you create ahead of time or make a request of your son? Or is it intentional to leave it to the community or someone else to create for themselves?
Well, this conversation has actually been going on with my doctor and other people, my oncologist. And it's new to me, but this conversation's about health and healing. I'm seeking alternative medicine, but that quite didn't work out. And the whole process that it takes to deal with an eventual factor in your life. So, and, you know, sort of my health and it's not being 100%, I really throws me off, and pain throws me off. So, no, I do been thinking about it because it's present and I have to deal with it. And every test I take and it comes back and my PSA is high and my this is low. So it's dealing with that. And when you're younger, you never feel you're going to get to this point.
But unless you hang out with Ned.
Yeah.
And then we're acutely aware. I mean, for you, Ned, how do you bring this home?
He's young.
Yeah, yeah. No, let's see. Let me put it this way. I'm 39, so I'm going to be 40 next year. I'm thinking of having a birthday that's just a big show that I do called Ned's Dead Baby, and then everybody can just come and actually perform as if I died already. I feel like these things I hear about where people have their funerals before they're gone, I mean, come on, that's amazing. So yeah, I'm kind of overly fixated on my eventual death, and how do I bring it home? You know, how do I get into my life and maintain some sense of balance and centeredness? I would like to think the wonderful part of doing this show is that I'm doing the work personally of being with that truth, and that when I go home, like I will after this, and get to be with my son and my daughter, my aliveness and presence of being is shifted because I just talked about this with all of you for 52 minutes. 52 minutes.
52 minutes. I think that's the place to conclude this conversation. Our guests this hour have been René Yáñez, curator of San Francisco's Dia de los Muertos, and Ned Buskirk, creator of YG2D, You're Going to Die, Poetry, Prose, and Everything Goes. Thank you both for being the conveyors of such beautiful art and ritual in our community and giving each of us permission to gather in honor of those who have died before us and our own impending death before us. And thanks to you, our audience, for joining us live at the Here Collective in the heart of the Mission in San Francisco, with a very special thanks to our hosts, Ellie and Matthew McGraw, whose generosity and spirit infuses this space, rippling out wide into our community well beyond these beautiful walls. This special program of Dying to Talk is produced by KALW at the Here Collective in San Francisco. Barbara McVeigh is our on-site producer, and Chris Locius is at the controls. Matt Martin is the advising producer, and Ashley Ann Krigbaum and Joanne Marr created the promos. And thanks to our KALW volunteers, Tim Olson and Jeannie Amos, for managing the tables. All of the music for Dying to Talk is by the Oakland-based band The Kilbanes. Can't wait to share what you just heard. This program, along with all the resources from today's conversations and others, are available on the Dying to Talk webpage at kalw.org. I'm Dr. Dawn Gross, inviting you to be curious, ask questions, and never settle. Or as a hospice patient once taught me, life is uncertain. Better eat dessert first. In the moonlight, starting to feel